The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Unlimited broadband so you can download, upload and stream as much as you like.
My guest this morning is from Glendore in West Cork, beautiful part of the country, but she has quite the story to tell and says that she would rather relive the worst tragedies in her life than have to go through what she went through. And she's here to tell her story this morning. Rachel Gatto, good morning and nice to talk to you.
Great to talk to you, Ryan. Good morning.
People will detect an accent that doesn't sound Corky. So give us a sense of who you are, despite the fact you were born there. Trace it for us, if you wouldn't mind.
The accent actually comes from because we arrived into Ireland in the late 60s. And a bit of an unusual arrival, actually, because we came in on a boat and sailed in an old leaky wooden tub. And the real story was we were due to go to New Zealand to live. And we were just calling into Ireland for a little bit of a visit. And then we were going to head on to New Zealand. And I thank the universe to this day that we never left, because secretly, Ryan, I don't think that boat would have made it. And I'm pretty glad to say that I was born in West Cork and happy that I spent my childhood there, I can tell
you. You're happy that the anchor went down and and rooted you to the spot.
Absolutely, yeah.
So you enjoyed life growing up in Glendore? You enjoyed West Cork, broadly speaking?
Yeah, I did. I mean, the great thing about growing up in West Cork was that we had a very free, natural upbringing. We were lucky enough to be able to cross the road and head into the water. I knew how to mackerel fish at the age of 5.
Oh, what a great thing to do.
Yeah, you know, it was a great childhood. I mean, it had bonuses and it also had its sort of drawbacks as well, because, you know, children always want to blend and children always want to be the same as everybody else. The only thing that I found really difficult was I came from a very English family.
Yes.
Inserted into a very lovely, gorgeous rural community with gorgeous people in it.
But you were other.
I was other. I was an immigrant. Mm. And so I always felt different. And I think that's the reason why my accent is a bit funny, because I was English at home and I was Irish out and about. But a gorgeous upbringing in the sense that we had the freedom that a lot of children don't have now.
And a lot of your story is influenced by nautical endeavour. It's the water, the sea.
Sure.
Living in the coast, a beautiful coastal village like
sure.
that would have informed a lot of who you are.
Absolutely. And my father and my mother began what was one of Ireland's first yacht chandleries at the time, in the late 60s actually. So it was always part of our upbringing. It was part of our lives, part of our livelihood.
Yes.
And of course, we were interacting with people in the community, because there was fishermen over in Union Hall, another gorgeous village in the same harbour. And, you know, so we integrated beautifully in that way and earned a living. And my family still earn a living to this day from the sea. So we have a lot to be grateful for.
I understand. I'm going to jump forward, if you don't mind, a little
sure.
bit to some of the stories in your life that have, punctuated your adventure in the world. But your brother, speaking of adventure, Dominic was an adventurous soul by all accounts.
He was a very adventurous soul. He was just a year and a bit older than me. So we were called the Irish twins. I think you know.
That's right. We know all about
that.
You know
all about those. Yeah. So we were those. So when we both left home together, and we had a bit of a sort of fractious childhood, so we were both pretty keen to get going.
Sure.
And I headed to Dublin and Dominic headed to the Caribbean. And he became a delivery skipper for delivering yachts between the the Mediterranean Sea and the Caribbean. So that was his joy and his livelihood. And he just loved the sea, as I do.
Sure.
Yeah.
And he was at just 26 when he was struck by that awful illness.
Yeah, it was, I mean, obviously major tragedy in our family and for me, because Dominic and I survived a lot together. So when he got ill, I felt as if I got ill too.
Yeah.
And he was diagnosed with bowel cancer at the age of 26.
Terribly young.
Yeah, it was unheard of in those days.
Yeah.
And it was almost they had to retest, because it was just something that was unheard of. But sadly, the march of that terrible disease that a lot of people unfortunately have to live with nowadays, it was rampant and he was very young and it was hard. He also eschewed normal treatment. So Dominic and I travelled the world looking for a cure.
Really?
And yeah. So I was his minder for many years. So it broke me. And some of me went with him that day in, you know, November 1996 when he died.
At 28 years old.
28 years old.
That's going to hit you very, very hard. No doubt
Absolutely,
about it.
Absolutely, yeah.
On a happier note, you were to meet your husband, Nick.
Yeah.
Where did you meet Nick?
I met Nick in my restaurant. I started a restaurant in Glendore when I was 23. I had some flats and a shop and a restaurant, and he swanned in. And the minute I saw him, I knew that there was something about the man.
What was it?
There was an air about him, and there was an air about me.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, that's chemistry, isn't it?
Yeah, it was chemistry. So the minute I saw him, it was actually his voice, and I was drawn to him, and I knew he would be significant in my life at some point. So
did you really?
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
And he sure was to be significant, because he would become your husband.
Yes, very quickly.
Very quickly. And you were, again, he was a man for the sea. Here is another, the connection continues. What was his connection to the sea, broadly speaking? Mm.
Well, he had a lot of connections to the sea, and he was doing a lot of research for UCC because he was all about sustainability and preserving stocks of fish. And so he was involved with UCC on a scientific trial to try and spawn scallops, actually.
Really?
In captivity, so we could release them into the wild. And I became involved in that project. And he was also involved in scuba diving. And we had a scuba diving business eventually taking people to the exciting wrecks that are off the south coast. And there's some beautiful ones.
And that brings us to that time when you were going out to a wreck. It was a lovely summer evening.
Mm.
Nick would have been about 42 at that time.
Yeah.
You were pregnant, and there was a wreck off Castle Townsend, which was, could you tell me about the nature of the trip before we get into what happened on the trip?
Yeah, sure. It's indelibly written into my soul, that story. Yeah, I was about 6 months pregnant, and we'd only been married 8 months. We'd been together some years, but we only got married the December before, and life was just starting to take off again after Dominic died. I was still bereft, but I was starting to live a little bit. And of course, we had this beautiful hope of Nicola, who was to be born. So it was like life was just starting to begin again, and the sun was beginning to shine a little bit. And so it was a beautiful July evening. I cannot tell you, you know those July evenings that are just pristine?
Magical.
No wind, golden sun, sea is flat. So I wasn't due to go on the boat that night. Because I was pregnant, I wasn't scuba diving. And Nick came to me. We had his two daughters from a previous relationship staying, and I was going to fix them up for a disco. Mm. And so I hummed and hawed, and he said, look, it's such a gorgeous evening, please. And so I said, okay, go down to the boat, get the boat ready, and I'll drive down after you, and I'll take the boat out. And we had 12 divers that night, so it's a big, big evening. And they go in on twos, so we had six pairs to go in. So my job would be to take care of the boat and put the divers in safely and retrieve them all safely to the surface. So we left Union Hall steaming out to the islands, and leaving Glandore Harbour, there's Adam and Eve Island. It's just beautiful. It's a gorgeous view. So the sun was in my eyes, and just the sea was glassy and calm. And we were heading west to the Kowloon Bridge, which is actually Europe's largest wreck. Not so deep, but a fantastic dive. And so that's how we left. And it was just that feeling of, life's all right.
Yeah,
you know, I'm happy with the life.
What a glorious setup, in the sense that you were just on the cusp of so much potential.
Yeah.
And what happened?
Cusp of so much. And what happened was a standard dive. So the procedure would be each pair go in backwards, tell me they're okay, and then descend. So I put all the other divers in, and then Nick went in with his buddy. And the procedure then would be to go up above the sun so I can see down on the water, so I can see if anyone comes up. Mm-hmm. And so I did that, and I was just turning the boat, and then I saw an arm in the water waving at me. And when we wave in scuba diving, we don't wave if we're happy. We put a sort of an okay sign. There was an arm doing that, which means emergency. So immediately I move the boat down alongside, and the next thing I hear is Nick's convulsing on the bottom. I can't get him. And it took me quite some time, to just a few seconds, to really click in that, okay, this is an emergency. And I'm pretty good in emergencies, but when it's your own husband, there's a hurry and an impetus that you wouldn't normally experience. But I'm very lucky I did respond as I had been trained. So immediately click channel 16, call a mayday, alert the authorities, request a helicopter, chopper to come, because we know when somebody's been scuba diving and anything happens at below the surface, it will be a chamber, which is in Galway. So we knew we needed a chopper, I needed an ambulance. I didn't know how many other people were injured. So there was a huge rush to recover him onto the boat. And I took a look at him. I did the usual CPR sort of procedure straight away, but I knew his lungs were full of water. I heard the gurgling, and for some reason I just walked away. And I remember thinking, why did you just walk away? And I was arguing with myself inside. Mm-hmm. It was just, when I look back, I think my brain was splitting into two. It couldn't cope with all the detail. So what I did was I went straight back to coordinating with the helicopter and the lifeboat and the police and all of this. And my colleagues, my scuba diving colleagues, were highly trained. They moved straight into CPR and all of the what would be expected when somebody's drowning. So I pretended it wasn't happening. Mm. Quite really.
Denial.
Denial, absolute. Mm. And I look back over the years and I think my brain just went into one different mode. And that was fine. And I'm totally fine with that. Mm-hmm. What happened after that was the helicopter eventually arrived because it actually had to refuel at Shannon, which does delay things. And I remember hearing the sound of the scudding of the Sikorsky as it came into view and then above the boat and the water whistling round us. And then this man, it's just like something out of science fiction, coming down on a rope and joining the boat. And I watched and I saw him and I saw the shaking of the heads and I saw everything happening. But again, I was pretending to myself, this isn't happening. Yeah. This isn't Nick. This isn't me. This isn't my life. And the next thing, I see him just being raised from the deck with a sling around his chest. And he disappears up into the sky. And I'm in horror staring at this. And I said, where am I going? And they looked at me and they said, you're pregnant. You're not going anywhere. Mm. And I said, but I've got to go. I've got to go up in that helicopter. And I remember one of the RNLI members coming up to me and putting both hands on my shoulders and saying to me, Rachel, I'll bring you into Glandor. It wasn't until I was standing at the entrance to the A&E, you know, the window where you go and sign in, and I was calm as a breeze and I said, hello, my name's Rachel Gotto. I'm here to see my husband. And that's the level of denial I was visiting. Yeah. And it wasn't until a nurse came over and tapped me and pulled me out of the queue. And I said, how is he? And she said to me, Rachel, I'm sorry, he's dead. And that moment was really the only moment when I was able to take it in for a little bit of time. And I felt my pregnant tummy lurch. I felt Nicola inside me turn over and I knew that things had changed irrevocably then.
Good Lord. And Nicola was born how soon after?
Nick died on the 24th of July 1998 and Nicola was born on the 3rd of December. So a couple of months later.
That sense of epic life and death in such a short space of time.
Yeah.
Is a lot to take on for someone who's not even 30 yet.
Yeah, I was 29. Yeah. It was kind of strange because, I mean, you're going to think this is a bit mad, but do you know what I did?
Tell me.
I went to bed and ate jam sandwiches.
For how long?
For a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But don't we all react to catastrophe in very different ways?
Yes, we do.
And if jam sandwiches in bed is going to help you be, as a salve, just keep going.
It was instinctual.
Yeah.
I think I had to keep Nicola alive. I had to birth this baby. Mm-hmm. I wasn't too keen on having a baby by then. Yeah. But I think it was my instinctual nature took over. I read a book about a man who drowned, actually. And my husband had drowned. The book was written by Naomi James and her husband had drowned off the back of a boat as well. And so I read a book about a man who drowned written by a woman who very kindly sent me the book. Yeah. So I ate my sandwiches, drank my tea and read this book.
Could I move to Nicola's was around 6 years old when you started forgetting how to drive a car and doing the things that we always do and you realised something was not up.
Mm.
What happened at that point, if you don't mind telling us?
Well, Nicola had been quite sick. She'd started to lose the sight in her left eye due to a very bad birthmark. So I was up and down to Crumlin and I was up and down to the hospitals in Cork nearly every day. Nicola never slept. I now know I had complex PTSD. I was living with the whole accident for years. So when things started to go wrong physically with me, I never really put two and two together. And so I might come out of the shop and get into my car and move my arm, but it didn't move. Or I might try and change gear and nothing happened. And one particular day, I was driving back from Skibbereen, the local town, and I had this urge to put my head out the driver's window. I couldn't stop myself doing it. It was a compulsion. And I remember sort of scratching my head, but never really thinking anything of it. And then I started to lose the use of my left leg at night. It would just buckle under me and I'd end up crawling to Nicola's cot to give her a bottle. So it was the combination of grief, stress, neither of us ever sleeping. Nicola never slept due to medication and all what was going on for her. I never slept because I had PTSD. So I took no notice. I thought I was a woman in grief. And so when I woke up with Nicola sitting on my chest, screaming at me, "Don't die, mummy, don't die, mummy," that was really the first I really took very seriously.
Time to get this looked at. Yeah.
And so I wasn't able to get off the kitchen floor that morning, and Nicola got the phone and we called my mother, and I just said to my mother, "I think there's something wrong with me." And that was all I said. And I said, "I think you ought to come over." So she did. And she was smart enough to know. And she turned up with the GP, and the GP heard my story. I'd had a massive seizure and I was unconscious and I'd gone black. And I think only by virtue of Nicola sitting on me was I still alive.
Really?
So I was taken to Cork, to the hospital in Cork. And they said, "Go and see them in the Beaumont in Dublin." So that's exactly what I did. And when I got to the Beaumont, he just took the, they were massive scans in those days, no discs, these big scans. And he popped them up on the lights and he literally just went like this, looked across, backward across, took them all down, put them in the envelope and handed them back to me and said, "I'm really sorry. There's nothing we can do here. If we operate on you, we will kill you. You won't survive."
Good Lord. A brain tumour.
A brain tumour, a benign brain tumour that was growing, and called an AVM. They're very rare and often they take off at a rampant rate when pregnancy occurs.
Let me bring us along the road, if you don't mind, because it's a long road. Given what you've been through, it's amazing. And how you look like somebody who hasn't had a common cold, let alone all of these things happen to you. But despite the dire warnings that, as you've just mentioned, you did eventually go to Bristol. You had a 15-hour surgery and you woke up with paralysis down your left side that would have had a massive impact on your life. And it's that impact that brought you to, I suppose, benzos, as they're commonly known as. And I'd like you to tell me about, why did you have to come off them and what was the impact of that withdrawal?
Well, I was put on benzos, or benzodiazepines as they're known. Mine was called Frisium because I was having major seizures post-surgery and they couldn't stop them. So basically they were adding in more and more medication, which was the right thing to do. And we managed to get my seizures controlled for many, many years. But as my seizures were controlled, my quality of life was going down and down and down and down. And benzodiazepines are drugs that we become dependent on very, very quickly. And there's a lot in the news about benzodiazepines now because we have new prescribing indications, because we can become dependent on them in as little as 2 weeks.
Right.
So they're usually used for acute situations. And in my case, when you've had neurosurgery, often they can be used more longer term for controlling seizures.
And can you tell us the list, the sorts of things that were happening to you?
Yes. I was on them for 9 years, which is an enormous, a long time. So I was becoming more and more depressed. My life was like a flatliner. I had no ability to experience any ranges of emotions. I had acute insomnia, constant. I never slept at night. I was getting brain zaps. I was being electrocuted through my feet. Unusual circumstances, unusual symptoms that became a whole. So basically, I was living a twilight life. I was unable to enjoy myself unless I drank alcohol, which, of course, I found out years later that alcohol works on the same receptors as benzodiazepine. So I was, in effect, updosing any time I had alcohol. And I was able to drink quite a lot of alcohol, strangely. Yeah. But what had happened was I had become physically dependent on benzodiazepines, which means that it's not like recreational drug addiction. Mm-hmm. It's actually a physical change within the cells. So it is incredibly dangerous to stop taking these drugs without a long and protracted withdrawal.
So is the withdrawal, or cold turkey, to use the expression, is it as vicious as you'd see somebody with a heroin addiction coming off it? Is it that tough?
Yes, and more.
What effect
it happened to me. I can describe it probably as how we would imagine somebody coming off alcohol and being a chronic alcoholic. I was delusional. I was quite mad, insane, quite insane.
Yeah.
I had delusions of beetles running around my arms. Earlier on in the day, I'd seen a hedgehog with worms on it. And I actually imagined then that I'd black worms in my mouth. I was sweating profusely. I was pacing. I was raging. Quite horrific. A few hours later, some part of me that wasn't mad, that had stayed sane, said, "Take the drug." go and get the drug, take it again. So I opened one of the blister packs and popped another one of the tablets again. Within about an hour, I'd stabilised back to my sort of flatline state. So I knew that the advice I'd been given was wrong. And somehow I needed to figure a way to do this. And so I researched and I came across a wonderful lady called Professor Heather Ashton. And she was the only person at the time who'd done any trials on withdrawing from benzodiazepines. And she'd written the Ashton Manual, which in effect saved my life.
And I believe benzobuddies.org is another friendly place to go for you.
Yeah, and I felt really ashamed about going onto the internet looking for support, but there was no support because the muted story about me was that I had an underlying psychological disorder and that actually I needed psychiatric help.
Yes.
And I knew that I had a serious issue on my hands and that I needed to withdraw slowly. So when I found benzo buddies, they had all the experiential information I needed. It was anecdotal. Mm. But actually, it was a lot safer than what the wisdom was within the medical community at the time. Now, we know in the medical community now, they know that it is long, slow withdrawal that is the only safe way of coming off benzos, particularly if you've been on them a long time.
How are you now?
I am really well now.
And how do you feel about the word happy?
I'm famously known for it not being my favourite.
Why not? Because you seem like a happy person.
I'm a very content and joyous person.
Content, that's a great word.
Yes.
So what's wrong with the happy then?
I just feel that happiness is a peak that we're always looking for. It's somewhere out there, we're reaching for it, and it's something you don't have or you do have. And to me, that encourages people to reach out of where they're at now. And my belief, Ryan, is that we have it now, even if you're going through the worst time ever. Because there's always something tiny that you can be grateful for.
Yes.
There's always something good or there's a purpose. Contentment is, to me, like the foundational basis for our lives. Because, again, we only need to look around us and we can compare ourselves to somebody else. Somebody's worse off or better off. We're all created to lead a life's purpose. And that is you and me individually.
Yes.
And
sure.
You are not me and I'm not you. So I just think it's a wonderful thing that if we can encourage and invite people to find purpose and meaning through contentment and joy. Joy is a beautiful word. And it's something that you can withhold and hold within you that is constant. Happiness to me is pivotal and dangerous. We either have it or we don't, or we're still seeking for it.
Well, it's been very good to meet a very content and contented Rachel Goddard this morning.
Thank you.
Thank you for sharing a story, extraordinary story. And we wish you every contentment in your life in the future.
And you, Ryan.
Thanks for
you.
Your time this morning.
Okay, bye.
Thank you so much. The text number 51551.